Today, we're going to talk about something that defies rationality. It defies the way we like to think that the universe is ordered, but it's something that is also absolutely real. And there's ways to think about this thing that involve spiritual explanations about things that come out of the ether and, you know, gods and demons and that sort of type of explanation that many people find very compelling. And the other way to think about it is there's actually a very rational, psychobiological way to talk about how this type of action manifests itself on the earth. We're going to be talking about curses. And I know this sounds crazy because curses aren't real, right? Like they're just words that people say. And I'm sort of inclined to agree with that perspective. On the other hand, I can say without a doubt that I have been cursed in an almost supernatural way 3 times in my life. And I want to tell you the story about how those things happened and how the curses resolved. And I'm going to let you decide if this is just pure madness or if there's something to it that we should think about in a more complex way. And as I said, we can talk about the spiritual side and the noumenal realm, but there's also a psychobiological way that these things work. And maybe those two things intersect in really, really interesting ways. The first curse that ever afflicted me happened when I was living in India. And interestingly enough, most of my curses have some connection to India. In my junior year in college, I spent a year in India, and the first 6 months I was learning Hindi in the desert state of Rajasthan. And in the second part of the year, I was living in the Tibetan areas where I met the Dalai Lama. I, you know, worked to learn Tibetan very poorly. And this is important because when I met the Dalai Lama, he gave me a blessed string. I know this sounds somewhat silly, but in the Tibetan tradition and also the Indian tradition, when you meet a holy person, they will give you a memento of that event. And this is often a red string that you carry around your right hand. You tie it around your right hand. And the idea with this string is that it's a memory, a token of your holy audience. And that when that string breaks, you carry it on your wrist until the time that it breaks. And when it breaks, you will receive a blessing. And this is important for the story. A few months after the meeting, I'd been holding that string on my arm for actually quite a long time. It was getting ratty. It was falling to pieces. And, you know, I actually had 2 on my wrist, 1 from a Hindu holy man, 1 from the Dalai Lama. And I was traveling through South India with 3 friends of mine, and we got on a bus. And I believe we were outside of the city of Hampi, maybe in the city of Hubli, when our bus broke down and it was the middle of nowhere, and we were gonna have to wait for like 7 hours for the next vehicle to come and pick us up, which is a pretty routine thing to happen in India at that time. And, you know, the 3 friends were all hanging out and talking, and there was this one guy who clearly had some sort of issue with the 3 white people in the group. And I have no idea what it was because we didn't say anything to him, but he had clearly taken offense with us. And he looked at us sort of meanly, and he was sort of a wiry younger gentleman, I think probably maybe 24, 25, not dressed in any particular interesting way. And he then started mumbling to himself and put us to the left side of his body, which in India is the dirty side of your body, and circumambulated us 3 times, saying something under his breath and giving us these cross-eyed glares. I mean, it was weird, right? It was a weird thing. And he was angry at us for a reason that I cannot pretend. I mean, maybe he was legitimate. Maybe we'd done something stupid. But he walked around us, and I just felt this evil energy on me. And then, you know, like 2 minutes later, after he was done circumambulating us, the string on my wrist fell off. All right, so maybe not much of a curse, right? But I did see this weird coincidence between the particular timing of the string falling off and what this guy's weird evil intentions were. But no harm, no foul. We were more or less fine. Okay. A few days later, we proceeded north on our way to the city of Udaipur in Rajasthan. And our bus stopped in the town of Ahmedabad, which is the capital of Gujarat. It was probably 2 or 3 in the morning, and we were only going to be there for a few minutes as the bus refueled. We took on more passengers. And then this woman walks onto the bus, and I know, I can sort of see her out of the corner of my eyes. I know that it's not a woman, that this is a hijra. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with Indic traditions, there is a cultural practice of transgenderism in India that goes back several thousand years, where men who are born gay or decide that they are women trapped in men's bodies and they don't fit into society will sort of enter this outcast group, a group that is by Hindus considered quite dirty, and they will don women's clothing and in many cases remove their testicles in a pretty brutal ceremony. I mean, this is before any sort of plastic surgery in America. And, you know, the way it happens is they sort of tie off the testicles and the penis and chop it off with a machete. I've spoken to hijras who've done this and interviewed them for other stories. But they're considered, you know, ritually cursed people by many, many Hindus. And they're a community that's generally avoided, for better or worse, however you want to think about gender norms in America. This is a different tradition. And they'll often beg to make their money. They'll also engage in sex work. And a hijra comes onto the bus and starts begging for money. And usually what they'll do is if you don't give them money, they'll lift up their saris and wave their genitalia at you if there are any genitalia there. So it's not always a pleasant experience. And she goes down and says, money, money, does anyone have money? And then she sees me on the bus. And I'm like, oh man, another person asking for money, because you get accosted a lot in India. And I'm like, I just sort of shake my head at her, and she looks at me and her eyes open wide and she says, no money? Just like that. And then she takes her hand, left hand, dirty hand in India, and puts it right on my forehead and then just runs her fingers and hands right down my face in what is absolutely another curse. And then 5 minutes later, the other string on my wrist falls off. Okay, so these are stories that I've told many times, like these two curses, and honestly, they're not the biggest deal, right? These stories are that I had a protection spell, and then I had a curse spell, and somehow the protection spell may have protected me from something that was bad, and I don't even know what the bad thing was. And curses, well, you usually think of them as personified, like there's some sort of like direct action that happens and there's a reason for these things happen. But I didn't really know what people's motives were other than maybe I should have given money to the hijra. And actually, I did give money to the hijra after she did that. I was like, oh God, and here's like $3, have it. There were, of course, no long-lasting problems. I didn't get sick. I didn't get cholera. I didn't lose all my money. Like the curses from these people, you know, maybe they're prophylactically protected by the string on my wrist. But those are really just the beginning curses of my life, because there is this one other event which was much, much more serious. And it happened when I was reporting the book the Enlightenment trap. Now, for those of you who haven't read the book is about this charismatic guru named Michael Roach, who was teaching a form of Tibetan Buddhism in the deserts of Arizona. In fact, he's still teaching this esoteric form of Buddhism, which involves sexual rites. There was violence on his compound, and one man meditated until he died in the deserts of Arizona on a mountaintop. Now, the story of this organization is fascinating, and you should really just read The Enlightenment Trap to really understand what's going on. But for the purposes of this podcast, really what you need to know is that that group knew I was reporting on them, and they knew that I was digging up their secrets. I was telling people about a stabbing that happened on their land. I was telling about how they have misinterpreted Buddhism, and I was not a very popular person at Diamond Mountain. In fact, one time when I showed up after, it was probably my third time attending there, they had hired a Pinkerton guard who was armed with a pistol, in part to intimidate me. So it was a little bit of a dicey situation. Anytime you work with a fringe religious group who has their own ethics and morality and their own even idea of what the truth is, I mean, many of their members lied to me in ways that I could document. You know, you never really know what they're gonna do, right? You know, and when I told one of my cousins who I was visiting on the way out to their campus in Bowie, he offered me a handgun to defend myself if I needed to. And I don't carry a gun when I'm reporting. That's a bad idea in general. But people were legitimately worried about my safety. You know, sometimes these organizations go violent. It's a thing that happens. But there's another sort of thing that these organizations can do, which is something called spiritual warfare. Curses. And to understand how spiritual warfare exists, you need to suspend your disbelief for a moment in the world of cause and effect that you and I know and live in, where one action begets another action in the rational material world. Because in spiritual warfare, the idea is that there is a spiritual realm that rests on top or below the world that we live in, and it abides by its own rules. Depending on your religion, those rules could be quite different, but it is the place where human intention alone can affect the world. Now, we can say the power of positive intention. You know, we can talk about the placebo effect and how having good thoughts can make good effects. Well, there's the opposite, right? Which is the nocebo effect, which is the idea that bad intentions can have bad effects, especially on yourself. You know, if I believe something bad is going to happen, something bad might happen to me. Spiritual warfare takes that to the next level, right? It says there is this noumenal realm of spiritual activity, and I can intercede in it and affect something that is not my own body, but someone else's body. And, well, almost all cultures in the world have some element of spiritual warfare in their theology somewhere. And, you know, I was an anthropologist for, you know, many years. I was getting my PhD, and I dropped out in 2006. But I got to the dissertation stage, and one of my professors was, his name was Neil Whitehead. He wrote this book called Dark Shamans about spiritual warfare in South America. He studied a group called the Canaima, who are basically ritualized serial killers. These are real, actual humans. You can go meet these people who will stalk and kill people in nearby and even their own villages in order to amplify the terror. And then once the person dies, and they do it in a horrible, horrible way, but it's actually a fascinating read, Dark Shamans, go check it out. They will kill somebody over the course of a year. And once that person is dead, they will go to the grave. They will stick a straw into the grave. I guess they dig up the body somewhat. And then they'll suck out the nectar of the terrified human, and they believe this gives them the power of the jaguar. I mean, it's insane that this happens, but this is a cultural tradition that does exist in Guyana right now. And in fact, Neil Whitehead, my professor, said that he'd gotten cursed by a Canaima shaman, and he got really, really sick. He ate this sort of like weird food nearby a Kanaima shaman's house and got horribly ill, had to be evacuated to the capital of Georgetown. And no medication would fix him. And he went from one hospital to another taking antibiotics and you know, whatever they could offer. And the only way he got himself was cured was by going to a different shaman of the Alia sect. Alia is Alleluia. It's a Christian shaman in Guyana who actually cast another spell. And within a day or two, he got better. And the thing about Neil, which was fascinating, and also creepy, is that the reason he got cursed by that Kanaima is because he took one of their ritual offerings that they had left out on one of these paths and one of their dark spells, and he took a little piece of a human skull and put it in his pocket as a, you know, I guess maybe as evidence of his work. I don't know why he did that. And that was what maybe provoked the attack on him. And the story goes that he actually came back to America and still had that little piece of skull and would sometimes touch students with it. This is true. Would touch students with it and say, now you've been cursed by the Kanaima, because he didn't really totally believe in the curse, but he sort of believed in the curse. Well, when I was writing the book, The Enlightenment Trap, Neil White had died of cancer at a relatively young age. And so this event was, of course, on my mind as I was writing the book, The Enlightenment Trap. And I'd done most of my research. There still was a little bit of reporting to do left, but I took a fellowship at a place called Ledig House in upstate New York, which is a writer's retreat. I could be in more or less silence with a few other writers, and we'd be working on our manuscript all day in silence. And then at night have great dinners with each other and talk about literary things. It's a fascinating and fantastic way to write a book. Very, very fortunate to get this opportunity. And I was writing the middle and last chapters of The Enlightenment Trap. And to do this, I actually had to get into the heads of the people I was writing about. And you know, if you haven't read the book, one of the more important sections has to do with the death of my student, Emily O'Connor, where she killed herself on a meditation retreat in India, 2006, 2007, because she believed she was enlightened. And I had to get into her mind, and I was transcribing her journal into my notes, trying to really just feel who she was, which is, you know, in a way, a magical spell in its own way, right? Inhabiting someone else's mindset is a difficult task to do. I was also listening to lectures by Michael Roach because he had so many of them online, and I wanted to hear him. I wanted to feel him. I wanted to invoke him and bring him into my mental state so I could then put that back down on the page. I mean, this might sound a little like mental illness, but maybe writing is a mental illness. And then I got these notes from people, other reporters, who told me that they had been cursed by Michael Roach and that I should watch out. That's a weird note to get. But people were scared. It was a spooky group. People were scared that maybe these things called curses are real. I got a note from a woman named Karen Visser, who is a Tibetan Buddhist. I believe she was in Toronto. Former member of the group, or at least closely related to the Diamond Mountain University. And she was gung-ho about protecting the journalist because she wanted this story to get out into the world. And she wrote me a note and saying, Scott, you may not believe in curses, but Michael Roach has it out for you and they are casting spells against you. She said that she was connected to the abbots at a monastery called Sarah May, which actually Michael Roach was also somewhat related to, and that they were aware that things were going down and that they could cast a protection spell on my behalf. It would be cost $218. And I said, no, I don't need a protection spell. I don't believe in curses. I'm fine. Don't worry about me. And I kept writing and writing. And I started noticing that the words weren't coming real well. And also, things were going weird for me. a few days later, I'm on this retreat, and I get this note that my bank account has been hacked, and all of this money, and I didn't have a lot of money, all of this money was being spent on athletic goods in Nigeria. I was like, whoa, what's going on there? I got a note from my wife saying that things were on the rocks with us. Like, things were not going well with us at all. And I also learned that some other journalists were also hot on the trail of Michael Roach. And there was part of me that was worried that my story would get scooped, because books have a long timeline ahead of them, and that I could, you know, potentially my book wouldn't go anywhere. So all of these things are on my head, and I'm in my silent room, and then I hear a buzzing. Bzzz, like a buzzing. And I look around, and I look at my pillow, and there's a wasp sitting on my pillow. I'm like, oh, wasp. All right. So I'm like, cool. And I sort of wave the wasp away, and I shoo it outside. I don't kill wasps. It's not my thing. I shoot it out the window, and I went back to work. And then 2 or 3 minutes later, zzz, I turn around, and there's a wasp on my pillow again. And like, for the entire week that I'm there, there's always a wasp on my pillow. In the Tibetan tradition, different deities are invoked by different insects and animals. And, you know, there are certain deities that are spiders. There are certain deities that are wasps. There are certain deities that are various things. And there was this rumor that Michael Roach worshipped this deity called Dorje Shugden. And even mentioning his name is dangerous in the Tibetan tradition, because he is a banned god. He was associated with murdering members of the Dalai Lama's entourage. Well, his followers are responsible for the murders, but it all comes back to the god. And there's a really interesting article about Dorje Shugden that you should definitely check out by George Dreyfus about the weird supernatural history of this god who the Dalai Lama banned from ever being worshipped among Tibetan circles. Because it's said that Dorje Shugden, if you worship him, you will get what you want very quickly. Your heart's desire will be achieved quickly, but you'll do so at the penalty of your soul and your karma. It's a dangerous god to worship. And it's said that Michael Roach may have been a Dorje Shugden worshiper. And I'm looking at this wasp, and I'm seeing it always over my pillow, and I'm freaked out. And I started to see things too. You know, throughout the day, there was like this dark shadow that was always sort of in the corner of my vision. I'd turn to look at it, it wouldn't be there, but I'd look away, and in the darkness, there was this thing that was following me. And it was freaking me out. And I didn't know if I was mad or if I'd been cursed or if this is some psychosomatic thing playing on in my brain. I didn't know, but I did not. I decidedly did not like it. Now, before I go on, I want to give you a little bit of anthropology for a second, because I think it's important and it's pretty relevant to what we're talking about. And I mentioned this at the beginning of the epilogue of my book. I have this whole passage, and it's by E.E. Evans Pritchard, who is one of the most important anthropologists to work in the 30s. And he wrote about witchcraft, oracles, and magic among the Zande tribe in Africa. And Pritchard was trying to understand why people believe in magic. Because, you know, the Zande are not idiots. We shouldn't look at them as children who can't understand the way the world operates. They're not crazy. Their beliefs make sense. They make sense in their own cultural context. But we should not just throw out the way they understand the world just because we understand the world differently. Evans Pritchard wanted to know why the Zande believe in witches, and why they believe that the witches curse people, and how that explains so much about their worldview. I'm going to read a short section here. You can ask a member of the Zande tribe about the cause of a man's suicide. How did he kill himself? And he will tell you that he committed suicide by hanging himself from the branch of a tree. You can also ask, why did he kill himself? And he will tell you that it was because he was angry with his brothers. The cause of his death was hanging from a tree, and the cause of his hanging from a tree was his anger with his brothers. If you ask Azande then why he should say that the man was bewitched if he committed suicide on account of his anger with his brothers, he will tell you that only crazy people commit suicide, and that if everyone who was angry with his brothers committed suicide, there would soon be no people left in the world, and that if this man had not been bewitched, he would not have done what he did do. If you persevere and ask why witchcraft caused the man to kill himself, the Zande will reply that he supposes someone hated him. And if you ask why someone hated him, your informant will tell you that such is the nature of men. The Zande believe that all actions, all inexplicable human events ultimately are personalized, and that there are supernatural forces at work due to hatred and love and other things that we can understand as, from an emotional perspective, but we cannot understand from a cause and effect perspective. Well, when I think of the Zande's worldview, I can't really rationally accept it. I don't believe in witches. But here I was, on my writer's retreat in my room with the wasp that just wouldn't go away, and I was starting to sort of understand. I was starting to think that maybe I was cursed. So I called up Karen Visser. And I said, you know what? That $218 to get 100 monks to chant my name in India, that sounds like a pretty good deal, if you ask me. And she said she'd get right on it. So I wired her some money. And within a day or two, monks in India chanted my name. They tried to undo whatever spell may or may not have been cast by Michael Roach on me. And she gave me a protection mantra, a sort of spell that I could cast to ward off the bad things that may be coming for me. And I still know that protection mantra by heart. Hri Benza Kroda Hayagriva Hulu Hulu Ham Fat. Say that again. Hri Benza Kroda Hayagriva Hulu Hulu Ham Fat. That was the prayer that I had to protect myself from Michael Roach. It invokes the god Hayagriva, who will intercede and protect you from really bad things that might be coming your way. And I started saying that mantra while I was writing the book. It didn't work immediately, obviously. And then I decided that I was going to take matters into my own hand. Whether I was cursed or not, I needed to do a ritual myself that would get rid of whatever the bad juju was that was coming at me. And I drew on, you know, I made it up. I drew on various traditions that I've been studying for years, but I don't know how to get rid of a curse. And this wasp was buzzing around my head. And I faced the window and I started taking these long, deep breaths, imagining that every inhale was positive light filling my body. And I exhaled this black mist of Roach's influence on me. And I did this and I went deep and I began to rock and back and forth in my chair for no discernible reason. I mean, I felt this sort of energy around. I was conjuring the energy around me. And then I just felt this rush. It came up from my stomach, this tingling, fiery thing, and it made it into my head. And it felt like heaviness was being lifted. I breathed in that positive energy and I expelled the muck that had been collecting in the bottom of my skull and making it so hard to write. And I gotta tell you, the relief, it was remarkable. And I felt better. I felt light. I felt like, oh my God, I somehow got this. I had my mantra. I had this feeling that I could do something. I could take control of whatever this bad stuff was. And as my meditation came to a close, you know, I still had those notifications on my computer, that little ping that they do. And my computer pinged. And there was a fresh email, and I'm sort of, you know, it took me a little while to sort of come to, but I walked over to my computer and glanced at it, and it was from one of these other journalists who was working on a story about Roach. And she told me that she'd given up. She didn't want to work on it anymore, and that she was going to send me all of her notes that she'd been collecting to see if it made sense. A few hours later, that money that was, you know, stolen from me in Nigeria, that came back to me too. And when I went back out to Diamond Mountain a few days later for the final reporting trip that I had to do, I felt like I was protected. And I had some pretty rough dreams about Roach. When I was there, I was sitting in a tent, lying down in my tent, and you know, there were storms out there. And I remember waking up one night, and in one of my dreams, Roach was like walking towards me, and he was like sort of putting, you know, just like shoving his face right in my face. And when I woke up, the tent, there was a windstorm, and the tent was blowing and actually pressing on my face. But I still had my mantra, and I still got out of it just fine. All right, so these are the three curses of Scott Carney. These are the three times that I have been cursed in my life and what I've done about it. There are curses and there are blessings. And you know, I'm agnostic in some ways about whether or not there are spiritual rules to the world that are not known by man. I mean, I don't know what happens when we die. I don't know the ultimate meaning of life on the universe. And I can't say the Zande are wrong, although I don't really believe in witches. But I do believe in curses. And it could be. And in fact, the most likely explanation is that you curse yourself, right? Is that somebody does an action. They let you know that you've been cursed. And then you feel cursed. And then you look around and everything that might be in the world that you could take as a bad omen, you personalize and you make part of you. And that can result in bad things. I mean, there's something called voodoo death, which is actually super, super well documented, where somebody who really believes in the voodoo religion, really, really honestly and truly believes that curses are real. And when they get cursed, when somebody points at them with the finger joint of a dead relative in their hand and they said, "You will die," that person actually dies. They actually go into this downward spiral and they feel their consciousness just can't hold on to life anymore. That has been documented many, many times. What we don't know is if there is magic involved, right? We don't know if there is some noumenal realm that gets accessed by your curse-er onto the curse-ee, and the death was inevitable, or if the curse relies somewhere in the psychology and the mind-body connection of a person who feels cursed. And I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that curses are real. I do know that you can feel them, and that they can start having bad effects on you. I can't explain why this apparent synchronicity of me doing that protection puja resulted in a journalist giving me her notes. Maybe there was no connection. Or maybe there was. I don't know. I mean, I'd love to know what you think about this. And I think there's no right or wrong answer here, right? I mean, you can sound crazy saying, "Hey, I believe in curses." And people will look at you like you are insane. But no one can truly refute it, right? We do know that they have effects in the world. I cannot explain why those strings fell off my hands over and over again in India. And I cannot explain how when it was apparent that someone was casting a spell on me, that my own little protection meditation worked. I cannot explain it from a truly, truly rational place. But I can say I feel better. If you also, you know, in my book, The Enlightenment Trap, there are other synchronicities that I talk about, especially in the new edition, where after the death of my student, Emily O'Connor, there were some weird synchronicities that occurred afterwards involving the repatriation of her remains to America that were inexplicable and almost miraculous, that should not have happened, where friends from my past suddenly appeared in Bodh Gaya. Bodh Gaya is in the middle of nowhere in India. And at that point, it was a bandit-infested area of India, a very dangerous part of India. And two friends from my past appeared in that city to help me repatriate her remains. And I do not have a good explanation for how that happened. There's a rational one. They got on buses and they arrived there. But I didn't invite them. And they certainly had no way to know that I needed them there at that moment when my student had died. This is one of those things about life that it's maybe better not to explain, right? Maybe these are things that we can just say, look, these things happened, and we can have a materialist view of how the planet operates, and we can get along just fine. I can live my life saying that these are coincidences. I can also live my life and say these are meaningful moments that give me lessons about how to be a person in the world. And I don't think there's a right or wrong way to go about it. I do think that you could read my book, The Enlightenment Trap, and think that I went mad by invoking Michael Roach into my life so much that I could get his personality into the very words that I was invoking, so that when you read the book, that you feel similar emotional reactions. Writing is magic, isn't it? Like writing, and if you're listening to this, if you feel an emotion, I mean, you might think the emotion is I'm mad, but you might feel emotions like, hey, this is spooky similarities to things that happened in my own life. If you're feeling an emotion, words are magic, right? I'm changing your biology. I mean, at least rewiring your neurons as you listen to me. I am changing your physical self as you listen to these things. Why couldn't a lot of intention being put behind words change something fundamental about you? Again, I don't have answers, but I'm curious. I'm curious to know how you've felt these things in the past. Are there things in the world that you can't explain, that things have happened to you that just seem so mysterious and inexplicable that you are generally a rational person, and yet there's a window to another way that the world could operate that makes you wonder if just perhaps the world is a more magical place than you could have ever imagined? I want to thank you for listening to this podcast. This is my, you know, fourth or fifth one, and I really, really, really appreciate you listening to my rambling and maybe my madness. And I'd love you to read the book, The Enlightenment Trap. There's an audiobook. I read it, with my sultry voice. And perhaps you'd like to listen to it as well. I don't put out enough of these episodes to keep it running all the time. But, you know, that's a good, like, 10 hours of me talking about these concepts. And I'd be honored if you would take some time to listen to it. I think it's an important book. It also explains how I got so interested in the Wim Hof method later and why it was so inexplicable that that happened. For those of you who are interested in those updates with the Wim Hof fight that I've been having since I released a video about some business practices that were a little shady from the Wim Hof method, there is a forthcoming update. It's a really, really big update. Stay tuned to this channel. Stay tuned to all of my channels, and you're going to get something which is pretty riveting. I can't give you details. But know that it'll be on this podcast, it'll be a video form, and there will be written forms of it as well. Really, really appreciate you coming here. Please tell people about this podcast. It's the only way that people ever find out about these things. If you found something interesting here, I don't know, tell a friend. Tell them personally. Don't, you know, you can tweet too. I love tweets. I love Instagram likes and whatever, that magic voodoo that we do on the internet, whatever that is. Yeah, that's all great too. But like, if something spoke to you here, tell a friend what you thought about and have a conversation. That's actually much more meaningful to me. Thanks so much for listening. From Denver, Colorado, Scott Carney Investigates by Pokey Bear, LLC.